This is The People's Game. As of today, half the games at the 2010 World Cup have been played. And what a show we have for you as the dramatic tension at the tournament grows ever greater. At the end of this show, we'll hear from the Honduran Resistance of Los Angeles, who have called upon the Honduran national team to make a statement of solidarity with those who oppose the 2009 overthrow of President Manuel Zelaya. But opening the show, we'll find out what's on the minds of our co-hosts, Jennifer Doyle, Pablo Morales, Spanish Maven Tony Presido, and myself. Then we'll speak with Tom Dunmore, the man behind one of the best U.S.-based soccer blogs, PitchInvasion.net. After that, a real treat, as Brenda, Jessica, and Suzette from Global Girl Media Los Angeles drop by the studio to talk about the stories they're covering during the 2010 World Cup. And then on to San Diego, where we'll be joined by Arturo Cifuentes, a Chilean football intellectual, who relates the joy in Santiago as Chile posts its second consecutive victory in a World Cup finals after a 48-year drought. We'll talk with Arturo about the place of football in Chilean culture, society, and history. All that and more on The People's Game for June 21st, the summer solstice and the 11th day of the 2010 World Cup finals. And welcome to The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
And I'm Pablo Morales.
And we have gotten to the halfway point in the 2010 World Cup soccer tournament, at least in terms of games played. 32 played, 32 to go. And today was a somewhat dramatic, though less than previous days this week, as Portugal made me look like a fool as I was championing the talents of North Korea. But I think what happened there, by the way, was that North Korea knew they needed a win. Once they went down 1-0, they opened up. I think they were exhausted from the effort they put in against Brazil. And basically, they were a team that could play and hustle and a defensive shell. But once they opened up, they were just vulnerable in the back and they got slaughtered. Very positive result for Portugal. And really the sad sort of collateral damage is done to Ivory Coast because North Korea opened up and now they have nothing to do but to play for their pride. The Ivory Coast probably can't expect to put in 9 goals against North Korea, and they're virtually eliminated from the tournament. I mean, something really amazing would have to happen to have a 9-goal turnaround in the next round of games. So what do you guys think about the tournament? We're halfway through. Let's just do the whole temperature of the tournament or the issues that are foremost in your mind?
Well, the foremost thing in my mind as a lover of Les Bleus is obviously the implosion of the team. And also I've been really intrigued by, not intrigued by, but frustrated with the coverage from CNN and ESPN, which have really misread a few different things, like Evra's statement to the team staff, which was filmed, and then the video of that was circulated on the web. And a lot of the ways in which that was framed made it seem like Evra had picked a fight. But my understanding of the situation is that Evra had approached the team staff to explain that the players were not coming to practice. The staff itself then basically exploded in rage. So that is very different from Evra losing his temper. And the reason why I point this out is because some of the press around this, in Europe especially, has been focusing on Anelka's halftime statement to Dominic, in which he basically was rude would be an understatement, and basically lost his temper and delivered a statement filled with expletives, which has been reproduced in the media. And the French players have been furious about the decision of the French Football Federation. I understand it's the Football Federation and not Dominic that decided to send Anelka home. And so the players basically took a strike action and refused to practice, which was a public practice open to the media. So this is a very visible refusal on their part to participate in the media spectacle of the French side. So today I checked in with my favorite French media outlet, which is for all things foot, which is SoFoot. And I think that's SoFoot.com. It's in French. I did a completely unauthorized translation of an article by Simone Capelli-Welter on basically the whole situation there. And it's a fantastic little editorial statement which points to this implosion as, in essence, a reflection of the hollowness of the multicultural fantasy that's built around the mythology of the 98 side. So this idea of this kind of post-colonial French team as being the face of the new France and as this image which is papered over the nation's basic failure generationally, especially to young people and to the immigrants living in France, that there's something to this editorial which is pointing up this this collapse, right, as a bearing out the overdetermined weight that this team plays within the media. So he's neither defending the team nor attacking the team, but just pointing to their overdetermined place within French media and then also the near inevitability of this kind of a collapse, because no team could possibly bear this sort of symbolic weight. I do think it's important for listeners to understand that this is, there's nothing more French than this kind of workers' action that they took. There is a possibility that this team could actually find its spirit in opposition, and it's an opposition which very intriguingly is not staged around Dominic, who's been by far the most controversial story of the year, right, in relationship to this Stade, is why this astrology-guided, strange figure is still guiding the team. They're not taking their stand against him, but their stand against the French football bureaucracy, which, I should say, looks nothing like the team. Right, that's basically an entitled class of largely white European men. I have no idea if that has anything to do with the sort of generational politics there, but I'm sure the absolutely soul-killing aspect of French bureaucracy does. And so I'm loving this story just as a kind of an insight into the inner workings of the French Football Federation and how players must feel about that. I don't think this is simply that a story of entitled, super-rich players who don't want to bring their game. I think these are players who are deeply, deeply alienated from the National Football Organization itself. And that's the first story that I've seen that makes some sense to me. So, of course, you know, we all have to deal with our own alienation in our work lives, so I think one can be a little bit impatient with that. Again,
well,
like
except on the People's Game, where we have a consensus-based utopia.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, but I do recommend those who read French to check out Sofut as an interesting outlet, and also larger French media, so you get a sense of actually the miserably racist and anti-immigrant stuff that comes up around talk about these different players. But and I've translated some of that on my blog, From a Left Wing, so I think that's right. A good place for me to end. Yeah.
Right, to find the stealth translations, go to From a Left Wing. Right.
I
just want to throw something out before Pablo, because maybe I thought Pablo might be a little interested in my take. 28 teams playing for their lives in the third set of first-round games. Only two teams through, right? Brazil and the Netherlands, and two teams out, Cameroon and North Korea. I think that is very rare, arithmetically very difficult, but it's come down to that. And so I believe if you are a super evil villain out there, a sort of James Bondian guy in your secret lair, these next few days will be the days to try to take the world over, because people will be dizzy, maddeningly dizzy from watching two soccer games at once over and over again over the next 4 days.
Well, I already know that in Bangladesh, the workers have managed to get a couple days off work just to watch these next couple of games. Mm. So it is affecting a large labor pool somewhere in a country that has absolutely no stake at all in the World Cup.
But it's so true that whole countries stop, and about half those people will go back to work when their sides are eliminated. So 12 more countries will be joining.
That's right.
About half the workforce will come back in within 4 days.
I think for me, the saddest part of this so far has been the inability of the African teams to take advantage of their home soil advantage. I was really looking forward to, as a sort of a longtime fan of the early Cameroon teams and later, I know I'm an outsider in liking Ghana, but I always liked Ghana, and I was hoping this Ivory Coast would have a great tournament. And not so much Algeria, because they're in the U.S. bracket, but and then the flip side of that, how well the South American teams are doing. Yeah. And although, like we mentioned earlier, that the Iberian teams have managed to have a good day and pull themselves out of the abyss a bit, overall, the big name European sides are struggling. And although that brings a smile to my face, it is just a very interesting how that compares to how the South American teams are just having very little problem this World Cup.
Right. And again, obviously, there are a whole set of big games tomorrow, one of which is South Korea versus Nigeria, because Greece against Argentina. And by the way, Argentina is not guaranteed to go through. They are one of the 28 teams playing, as obviously, for their lives, but heavily favored to go through and heavily favored over Greece, which means a victory by Nigeria over South Korea means they could go through on 3 points if it's a substantial enough victory. I think it would be probably two goals would be what they would need. So Nigeria, again, could, at least on the first set of games, the four matches tomorrow, determining which four teams go through from A and B. Nigeria still could be one of them, and that would be a big thing. Now, South Africa could as well, but of course that would take one team winning in Mexico and Uruguay. So France, South Africa, they play to win. Nobody's going to go through on a draw for that match. If it's drawn in the final stages, they'll be going crazy to score goals. The defense will totally open up, but it's contingent upon a victory in the Uruguay-Mexico match, or both teams have no chance of going through.
I guess, you know, these next couple of days, they're always the most fascinating for me in a World Cup when the games are happening simultaneously. I'm very upset that my TV does not do picture-in-picture. There's, I think, the larger sort of regional stories are kind of fascinating, especially when you, after 2002, when the Asian team finally kind of came of age, everyone said, and then 2006 in Germany, when they didn't play very well, the sort of the Europeans were saying, well, now we've restored order. You know, so there was a part of me thinking, okay, now they're going to go to Africa, and the African teams are going to do well, and that'll freak out the Europeans again, and that was very disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, that fantasy is built upon a real underrepresentation of the difficulties that African countries have faced historically in relationship to FIFA, the lack of monitoring of national FAs, and the administration of development money that FIFA gives to countries. I mean, there's a lot that people have not heard about, which I think helps to explain some of the reasons why these sides don't have a deeper career, actually, of doing well, given the obviously huge talent pool in Africa, which we know by virtue of their presence of these players are some of the best sides in Europe. So we know the talent is there. It's the structure that's, I think, letting us down now.
Ghana, 2 days from today, I do believe they go through with a tie, but, you know, Germany's obviously going to be going crazy to try to survive and win that match, because on the other side, Serbia and Australia is the other match in that group. And so even Ghana, on top of their division, they can't be favored to even go through at this moment, because you figure Serbia's favored and Germany's favored in that match. So it could be a 0-6 shutout, but again, it could be, still could be, five teams that could go through from Africa. So we'll see how it plays out.
There hasn't been a lot of good magic for the African nations this year, or so far in this tournament. It would be great if this is the round where things go well, when the ball bounces for them. It'd be interesting to go through each team individually and talk about it, but that's my general feeling about it. It's really hoping they'd be more of them in the top two going into the last game.
And lastly, since it's one of the local teams, Mexico, Uruguay, Pablo, of course, an expert on the Mexican team.
I just feel like there's all the talk whether or not they go in for a draw against Uruguay. They don't tend to have a really great record against South American teams, Mexico. Although I did read an article that supposedly said that they do. I couldn't come up with any in my mind where they did very well outside of Mexico. But a draw gets them in. So, you know, do they play for the draw and worry about Argentina later? That's the question.
Well, I think it is a fair question, too, in terms of, again, the emotional component of this World Cup, because being here in Southern California, it is possible Mexico will be eliminated tomorrow, which would be devastating.
Don't even talk about that.
to the experience of the World Cup in this region. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to bed right now here in Southern California and across greater Mexico, as it were, and saying, you know, guys, go for the tie, you know, make sure you go through. But we'll see how that plays out. And we're joined right now by Tony Presido, who is, of course, our resident expert on all things with the Spanish team. And I believe Pablo has a question for him.
My main question is, do you believe that the Spanish team of the first half of today's game is the one that shows up against Chile, or is it the one that lost to Switzerland?
To be honest with you, I think they've played unconvincingly the whole way through. I think there's a sort of lackadaisicalness to their style of play, where they string a bunch of passes together. They do really well. This like sort of like the romanticizing of their own style. They're able to do that, but then all of a sudden they get away from it. It's a completely inconsistent thing that's happening with them. I think they played better today than they did against Switzerland, but I still think Fernando Torres's like final touch was escaped him all day today. And even in the back, they looked flat a few moments, especially in the second half, like the last 20 minutes. So I don't know. I hope they show up against Chile with their A game and put them away. Like, I'm talking about putting them away like 2-3 nothing, you know.
They had a different formation today, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, they did. They came out with Torres and Navas, which I think was definitely a better formation than they had against Switzerland. And you know, but again, there's inconsistency to their play, and it showed again today. Not as badly as it did against Switzerland, but it was still there, you know.
well, by not having an extra center midfielder, they didn't have against Switzerland. They had so much of the ball. They were doing a la Barcelona, where everything was 5 to maybe 6 yard passing behind the forwards, looking for that last through ball. Switzerland shut it down, and they couldn't do it. So they opened it up, but because they opened it up, the game got stretched. And right. I felt that they weren't, you're saying they weren't in sync. I agree, but I actually think that they had so many more scoring opportunities because the field got stretched.
Absolutely, which I think would have worked to their benefit had they played that way against Switzerland. The way they played today would have been more effective against Switzerland, and it was definitely effective against Honduras. The issue is it's turned on, it's turned off, it's turned on, it's turned off. And there's a definite, like, I think a lack of desire, you know, in some of these guys. I don't really know what it is. I don't know if it's injuries. I don't know if it's, I have no idea. But I'm hoping that they rev it up for this last game against Chile and win convincingly and move into the next round. And I really don't care who they play first. I don't care if they play Brazil. You're going to have to play these teams to get through to the final and to win the final. So that's how I feel.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be watching again the final group, Spain's group with Chile, Switzerland, and Honduras, and we'll see how that goes through. But Spain will basically need to win over Chile to secure their advancing, and it's going to be very tight because if Switzerland beats Honduras and Spain just draws against Chile, Spain is out of the tournament. Thanks so much for joining us, Tony.
Thank you, guys.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and right now we are joined by Tom Dunmar. He has overseen a fantastic website in recent years called pitchinvasion.net. And I'm joined in studio by my co-host, Jennifer Doyle.
Hi, Tom. I'm so glad that you're here on the line with us today. As you know, I'm a big fan of your website, Pitch Invasion, and I sometimes contribute to it. And I should say to listeners that one of the things that drew me as a writer to the site is the readers of the site, who are really interesting, and there's not much of the kind of knucklehead fan discourse that characterizes a lot of the soccer blogging sites out there. It's generally very sensitive and interested, inquisitive readers, so they're fun to interact with as writers. So, Tom, I was wondering if you could actually, just to give listeners a sense of the work that you publish on the blog, some of the big stories that you guys have up on the site at the moment.
Sure. We started in 2007, and as you kind of intimated there, we've tried to be a part of a niche that looks at soccer from a bit of a broader perspective, hopefully. And we do have a very engaged readership and a lot of people that contribute, like yourself, Jennifer, that bring perspectives that aren't necessarily seen in the mainstream media on soccer here, which obviously has struggled to cover the game in any broad sense for a long time. So I think there's room there for soccer blogs to look at some of the cultural issues, the economic issues, the gender issues that don't necessarily get out there otherwise. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the World Cup, obviously, you know, you wait 4 years and then suddenly people that you never expected to start reading your blog show up. We've had a lot more traffic this World Cup, but we've tried to keep up a similar stream of stories that are a little different. One of our writers, Andrew Guest, our weekly columnist, is out there in South Africa. Not that we could afford to send him or anything, but he's packed himself off there. And he's been filing some interesting stories on some perspectives that haven't necessarily been seen in a lot of outlets. He's been looking, for example, at the development of the sport at the grassroots level in South Africa. He had a post yesterday that I thought was really interesting, looking at how far FIFA's promises about the World Cup bringing great development at the grassroots level were actually being realized in cities in South Africa. Mm. And from what he looked at least from his anecdotal experience, he found that being a bit of a letdown compared to some of the grand marketing promises that have been made about how wonderful the World Cup will be financially and culturally for the people of South Africa. He's not exactly finding that so far.
That's been a real theme in kind of alternative press coverage of the sport, and it's something like where I think I'm almost like looking for more upbeat stories, just because it gets so depressing when you it's like all of these different letdowns from all these different angles. You also have a story on your site about the London Falcons Gay Football Club.
Yeah, I just posted that this afternoon, sort of a follow-up to your own piece at the Guardian's website, vaguely on the same topic. I didn't know this club, but they play in a gay supporters league, and I thought it was just very interesting the way one of the players explained their decision to participate in an alternative league, separating themselves off from mainstream soccer, and the tension and the sort of internal question marks that raises as to whether it's better to separate off and develop, be part of a culture that's naturally more accepting to gay footballers, soccer players, or whether, in fact, it would be better to persevere in the mainstream despite the homophobic abuse that's still unfortunately far too prevalent in English soccer and soccer around the world for the most part. So I thought it was just fascinating to see that firsthand perspective on the tough decisions that some of us who don't have to face that kind of choice might never think about.
Yeah, I really appreciated that story because actually we don't really get that much. There is not an enormous amount, of course, of coverage of lesbian football teams, but they've been there have been some interesting portraits of, for example, the Chosen Few, a South African side, had a portrait appear in the Guardian just the other day. So it's nice to actually hear a little bit about the men's game and gay men and how they form as a club and work through these different issues. Would you care to comment on some of the bigger headlines that are emerging around the World Cup? For example, England's or France implosions or any of the recent games that have been providing us with some of the drama, our own different sorts of heartbreak.
Yeah, it's been interesting the way it's sort of exploded the last few days. The World Cup had a bit of a slow start, at least in terms of goals scored, and there wasn't that much excitement, I guess, at least no simple narratives. And then all of a sudden, France imploded and Italy had a poor result and England had another poor results, and suddenly, newspapers across Europe were going crazy about their teams failing. So it's not actually that surprising in a lot of ways. European teams have typically struggled in World Cups, not on their own continent. And a lot of these European players are obviously particularly exhausted and under so much pressure from their press back home that I'm not too shocked to see a country like France or a team like my own originally. I'm from England, but used to English disappointment. So I wouldn't say I'm too shocked, but it's interesting that these stories have all sort of broken through at the same time, and suddenly the World Cup seems to have a real storyline to it developing.
Yeah, and it's Portugal and Spain sort of picked themselves up today. Portugal spectacularly so, but you look down the road and actually the two teams would be set to meet each other in the second round right now, so you might have only very few European sides make it through past the second round.
Yeah, that's possible. We could have a World Cup without a European team in the semifinals, which would be interesting. But that said, I mean, we see in the course of a month-long tournament, it's amazing how quickly everybody changes their minds and their perspectives on specific teams and players. We've seen at past World Cups, teams struggle early on and then pick up momentum and a win or two on a penalty shootout, and suddenly you're in the semi-final or the final. So in a World Cup where it's only 7 games to win it, it doesn't take too much in terms of good breaks coming your way for the story to change, even if not that much really changes with the team.
How significant has the dramatic games played by the United States been to, say, the traffic on your website? Or is that just so inflated because of the World Cup? How much enthusiasm has been generated around the USA team?
I think there's been a lot. Aside from the blog, I've also been out and around in Chicago a lot at bars, even that early in the morning, to try and get a feel of the atmosphere. And I've never seen so much interest and attention and excitement about the U.S. team before. Obviously, Chicago is a very diverse city, so there's always been a fair bit of interest in the World Cup, at least the past two that I've lived in the city for. But I've never seen so much focus on the U.S. team, more bars that are, really U.S. soccer supporter bars that people congregate at to support the team. That hasn't really happened before in Chicago, I don't think.
I have the impression from your blog that the soccer community in Chicago is pretty tightly knit and also is very engaged with the MLS, with the Chicago side. And could you say a little bit about that and your glimpse at that side of soccer in Chicago, the MLS and local soccer scene?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's a very diverse city with big immigrant populations, particularly Mexican and Polish, who are obviously two of the most passionate soccer nations, and they all bring that here. I'm married to a Polish woman, and I know the Polish community passion for the game is pretty intense, and they're pretty annoyed that their country isn't in the World Cup this time. But around MLS, we see that feeds into the MLS team, too. We have a very diverse fan base. We have typically, a big mix of native-born Americans, of Polish people, Europeans, other Europeans, Mexicans, pretty much every country you can name. In fact, I've met someone who's a Fire supporter and also an immigrant from somewhere else that's learned to love the game there or mm-hmm. learned it here at a young age. So
I want to say that one of the things that I really like about Pitch Invasion is the feel that you have for not only the international game but also the local game in Chicago, and it's a real break to me from the fan. It's unfair to fault the fans for this, but they're fan-centered blogs. Big Soccer is one that I don't particularly like, but they're a big community on the web, and you're a real alternative to that. So I want to commend you on the stories that you publish and that you pay attention to, which I think give readers a better sense of the kind of organic side of soccer culture in Chicago. We're going to have to wrap things up because we've got a lot to cover today, but I look forward to having you back on to the People's Game to talk about the World Cup and your work on Pitch Invasion.
Yeah, we'd love to have you on. And just one final thought, your thought on USA versus Algeria?
I think the U.S. Will go through. I have a lot of respect for Bob Bradley and the way he's built a very tight-knit team that really cares for each other and plays hard for each other. One of the oldest tricks in the coaching handbook, but Bob Bradley, some of your listeners may know, was the Chicago Fire's coach back in the day, and he did the same thing here and led our team to a championship in its first season, and he's pretty much followed the same playbook with the U.S. He makes the most of his resources, and I think that'll see the U.S. through to the next round.
Thank you so much, Tom Dunmore from PitchInvasion.net, and we will have you back on The People's Game.
Thank you.
This is Rocio Ortega, and I'm a Global Girl Media reporter. What team do you go for?
USA! USA!
Yeah, go Mexico! Go my country! I love you guys! Honduras!
Mexico!
England!
Hi, my name is Jessica Cueva. I'm a Global Girl reporter, and I don't pick favorites, so go team.
Mexico! Mexico!
Yo soy de Guatemala.
I think Mexico's going to win it all, probably. I want Honduras to take it, and also Mexico because I'm half and half. But I think I want Mexico to take it the most.
Brazil! South Africa!
Japan!
This is Jennifer Doyle of The People's Game, and today I am here with representatives of Global Girl Media Los Angeles. The young women that I have with me today are all participants in Kick It Up, which is a branch of this feminist media activist program, Global Girl Media, which is concentrated on getting young women involved with reporting on the World Cup. So I'm going to ask the three young women that are here from Global Girl Media to introduce themselves one by one. And could you, in giving the listeners your names, tell us a little bit about yourselves, where you're going to school, and what part of L.A. you live in?
Well, my name is Brenda Solis, and I live in Lincoln Heights. And I'm currently attending the Los Angeles Leadership Academy High School, and I am a junior.
And what part of L.A. do you live in?
East L.A.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Jessica Cueva, and currently I'm attending Santa Monica College. And I live in North Hills.
Hi, my name is Suzette Nunez. I just graduated high school, and I'm going to be attending Cal State Northridge as a freshman, and I live in Hollywood.
Great. Thank you for coming in today. Now, these young women are part of a parallel program. There are eight young women based in East Los Angeles who are reporting on the World Cup, and there are 22 young women in Soweto working with Global Girl Media, also producing stories locally. So I wanted to begin by asking you to share with us the stories that you're working on right now and just tell us a little bit about what those stories are about and what's exciting to you about them.
Okay, well, it's split up into two teams of four, and there's the red team and the orange team.
Yeah.
The red team currently is working on a story based on how soccer has influenced their life. Like, for example, we're going to be interviewing her friend, and he used to be involved, like, in the gang life.
Mm-hmm.
And, or he was, like, becoming part of that, and we're going to talk about how soccer influenced him and kept him away from that thing, and eventually he just let go of that lifestyle, and
yeah,
he's currently all into soccer.
Yes, that's a big part of the story for a lot of young people in L.A. with their involvement with sports. And I should point out that the city actually acknowledged this recently with a program called Friday Night Lights, where they had the lights on at certain parks onto midnight, and they found that the rate of crime dropped by 80% in the neighborhoods where they opened up the fields and turned on the lights and let people play until midnight. So this is a friend of one of the reporters. And how was he when you approached him about doing a story about his personal life?
He was actually very thrilled and excited to do it, and he didn't even hesitate. He's just like, yes.
Where are you guys at with the story? Have you started doing interviews with him and with other players?
Well, right now we're looking at statistics. We're looking up some statistics to show how much a kid's involvement with sports and how much the violence in Los Angeles has decreased.
Yeah.
And we're hoping to also get this from the point of view of a police officer and ask him if he agrees with us.
Right. So could you tell me a little bit about some of the challenges of doing this story? Like, what have you learned as reporters as you're trying to get people to talk about themselves and their lives?
We've learned that as reporters, you have to be able to take no as an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we were doing another story asking, we wanted to ask people about their opinions about something, and the main answer that we got was no. So we just had to keep asking and asking until we found someone that said yes.
Yeah, so don't take no as an answer.
Yeah.
Right. There's another story that you guys are working on. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Orange Team, we just kind of finished up a MacArthur Park story.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to bring focus to this group, the Yes organization.
Yes.
And we interviewed Daniel Morales.
Mm-hmm.
And he just wanted to provide a place where children would feel safe and they can just go and play a sport that they loved, which was soccer.
And where are they playing? Where's Daniel Morales organizing these leagues?
He's organizing it in MacArthur Park.
Oh, great. And so what have you learned about YES as an organization and soccer in MacArthur Park?
We learned that there's so many people out there in MacArthur Park, and we interviewed this one guy, and he said that the one thing they all have in common is that they love soccer, and that's why they're there to play.
Mm-hmm.
And his answer it just summed up what the park was all about when we got there.
Like a sense of community.
Yes.
Unfolding around the around the sport.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like being young women doing these stories? How do you find people respond to you when you approach them with a microphone to talk sports?
A lot of people, like, they see a camera and a microphone, and they're like, they're just trying to get in there. But then, like, when they hear that we're still in school and, like, what Global Girl's all about, they're really surprised, and they're, like, willing to help out and everything.
Right, so people have been really supportive and responsive in a positive way because you're young women.
Yes, once we start to open up to them and tell them who we are, and we're not there to, like, you know, judge them and stuff, they start to open up and give us their story.
Were any of you involved with sports before you took up this project?
Yeah, I was on my school's volleyball team, and I'm on the swim team too.
Oh, great.
I used to play softball and soccer.
And what happened? What's that used to about?
In high school, when I went to college, I just decided to focus on education.
Right.
Yeah.
Ah. Says the professor.
Hopefully I'll return, hopefully. And I played volleyball and basketball last year.
And were you guys interested in sports as fans beforehand? I mean, is this your participation as journalists coming out of following the sport or being close to people who were fans? Or was this out of an interest in journalism more broadly and maybe getting involved as writers or as reporters?
I thought it was a great experience to be able to report on the World Cup because, you know, it's only every 4 years. And I feel like my family, they're not really a big soccer kind of family.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the World Cup, we all get excited and we always go for a specific team. And as I've been watching it lately, I've been learning a little more about all the different teams.
What team is your family going for?
My family is going for Honduras because we're from there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just thought it was really interesting because I feel like Honduras making it to the World Cup has a deeper meaning.
Yeah.
Like just the fact that they made it to the World Cup is a big deal because
it is.
Because lately they've been having political problems, you know, about the president.
Yeah.
He's just trying to rewrite the constitution, and it's just been like a whole negative thing in Honduras, and them making it to the World Cup has had like a big positive influence in, like, the country.
And what did you think of the game today?
I feel like Honduras played really good defensively, but they could have done better offensively. And not to lie or anything, but Spain is really is a better team than Honduras. I feel like they still have a lot to work on.
Yeah, Honduras.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, they played an honorable game, but it's an inevitable loss, which is somewhat depressing. Yeah. How about you guys? Do you come from families that are really passionate about soccer? Were you coming to this with your own love for the sport?
I used to love playing. Like, I still do, just playing for fun. But actually, watching soccer, I wasn't really into it. But my uncle, he's Facebooking, let's watch. You know, game starts at 7. I'm like, okay, I'm not that hardcore fan, but, you know.
Yeah. This is, again, Jennifer Doyle, and I'm speaking with Brenda, Jessica, and Susan, who are representatives of Global Girl Media. And we are talking about their reporting on soccer in Los Angeles and the obsessions with the World Cup. So could you tell me how you come to the sport and you're rooting for?
I'm actually rooting for Brazil. But my family, they've always gathered around to watch Mexico play at the World Cup. They always seem to make it every 4 years. And they don't really follow, like, throughout the year, they don't really follow soccer. But when the World Cup comes, like, they're, like, all on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as fans of Mexico. But you're breaking from the pack and
yeah.
you're a fan of Brazil, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So because of your love of the kind of classic style, or what is it about Brazil?
Brazil, I really like the player Kaká.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's really good. But
he's hard not to like.
Yeah. But Mexico,
even when he flops on the ground and was a little bit theatrical, you know, it's still all part of his game.
Yeah.
So, I just want to ask you if there are sports that are not related to soccer that you guys are working on. And I understand that the Global Girl Media Project is, of course, not only related to soccer. Global Girl Media's soccer branch is called Kick It Up. So what's the Los Angeles story you're working on?
Well, I feel like the majority of the stories that we cover should be based on soccer, but we don't really do other sports. We cover more stories more that, like, about high school dropout rate or just some personal facts or personal things that we feel interest us.
Right. The things that shape your lives as sort of young women living in East LA. And,
yeah.
And are you in touch with the girls in Soweto?
Yes. Actually, this Saturday, we spoke with the girls on Skype.
Yeah. So you got to see them as well.
We got to see them.
And what were you guys talking about? Were you bonding over things? Or?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting because, you know, we got to know them a little more as an individual. And, you know, we expected them to be, like, totally different. Like, some of them are really down to earth and they're really goofy and they
You expect them to be like? Were you...
Honestly, what? I didn't think they could, like... I thought they couldn't speak English or, you know... like,
right.
I don't know. I thought they would be stuck up or... But they turn out to be the complete opposite. They're really interesting people to talk to.
Yeah.
And... we actually learned a lot about them.
It was really funny to see that, like, one of their girls was kind of like our girls.
Yeah.
So we're in different, completely different places, but there's one of us in each place.
Oh, that's
which is really cool to see.
Yeah, that's a nice sense of connection and having things in common. Was it were the things that they had that you guys had in common, things about being young women of a certain age or about their relationship to kind of being involved with the journalism project? What were you guys actually talking about?
We were talking about our stories. They told us the stories that they were doing and we told them the stories that we were doing. Yeah. And then we were just talking about ourselves. We introduced ourselves and then we were just laughing over goofy things.
What did they tell you anything about what it's like having the World Cup in their country?
They didn't really, I don't know, that it was just very exciting over there.
Yeah.
And I know that they got to meet what Joe Biden's wife. And they got to interview her.
That seems kind of random, but interesting.
Yeah, because I guess they were there for the World Cup, and they got to interview her. And they ran into a couple players at the airport.
Right.
And so it's just crazy over there.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and they also told us about how a lot of people on the radio or on TV are saying that Johannesburg or South Africa doesn't have good people. Mm-hmm. But they actually left behind a tripod. And there was actually a man that left his number and they called and he actually gave it back to them. So they just told us that we shouldn't believe everything that they say on the news about it being a bad country because there's actually good people there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I can see it being important to actually communicate that. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming out this afternoon to talk to us and share a little bit with us about your projects and your work. So you have a Facebook page, I believe, for Global Girl Media, and there's a website. globalgirlmedia.org. And we can also, I know, follow your work on KCET.org on their website as well.
Yes.
I know that they're doing some cross-posting of your stories.
Yes.
So I want to encourage our listeners to check out your blog entries and your videos.
Please do.
Yeah. So thank you again. And before I leave, can I ask you who you all are rooting for in the World Cup? I know we have one person here back in Brazil.
I'm going for Honduras.
I'm going for the USA because they're the underdogs.
This is Jennifer Doyle with The People's Game. I want to thank our participants from Global Girl Media for coming out and talking with us today. Suzette, would you mind telling listeners how they might support Global Girl Media?
Yeah. Listeners can support our organization by logging on to globalgirlmedia.org. And you can do anything from checking out our blogs to giving a simple donation. $5, $10 is fine. Anything to support us would be great.
Thank you. Stay tuned, and we'll be back with more of The People's Game.
This is Alan Minsky. This is The People's Game, and I am joined by Arturo Cifuentes, who is in Santiago, Chile. Arturo Cifuentes is the director of the Financial Studies Center at the University of Chile, and in his previous life, he did earthquake engineering. So welcome to The People's Game, Arturo.
Good evening. How are you? Happy to be here.
I'm good, but I imagine you're better. So it was a second straight victory in the 2010 World Cup for Chile. What did you make of the game today versus Switzerland?
Well, it was a very exciting game because, as you pointed out, the last time that Chile won in a World Cup was almost 50 years ago. Yeah. So today, or actually this week, in the last week, Chile experienced two successful games in a row, which is a reason to be happy here, I guess.
So what are the streets of Santiago like after the final whistle blows and Chile is up to 6 points
in
their group?
Yeah, actually they were. The game was at 10 o'clock in the morning, and around noon, I was at the university at that time. There were students and people on the streets with flags and chanting and feeling happy about the entire thing. I mean,
what do you think of the team? How strong do you think they are, and how do they compare to the great sides of Chilean soccer history?
Actually, I think this team, for a couple of reasons, I'm going to explain in a second, it's a lot better than any previous team. First of all, they play in a quite different fashion. They play in a very aggressive fashion, which is not typical for a Chilean team. In the past, Chilean teams typically try not to lose by a lot, and they score a goal, then they kind of became engaged in a very defensive game. This team, partly thanks to the coach, who is from Argentina, has a very different mentality. They are very aggressive. And also, I think the fact that the majority of the players in the Chilean team play in Europe, and they have been exposed to different kind of much more, I would say, demanding and challenging environments, so they have benefited from that. So I think it's a fairly good team, yeah. I don't want to sound overly patriotic here. Brazil and Argentina, they have, in all fairness, a much better team. But I think this is a pretty decent team.
Now, Chile, of course, they, in a sense, they were a collateral casualty of Switzerland's huge upset over Spain, because they probably went into the tournament believing that if they won their first two matches, Spain would have done the same, and by the time they played Spain, they were guaranteed of going through to the second round. But because of the huge upset that Switzerland pulled over Spain, Chile is not yet advanced to the second round, and in fact...
That's correct.
Right. The game against Spain, going into it, they probably believe they have to at least get a draw against one of the top sides in the world, Spain. And if they do pull a draw, they would heroically, quite possibly even likely, be eliminating Spain from the tournament. So how do you see Chile matching up against the European champion, Spain?
Well, you know, at this point, I'm going to have to be a little bit, leave my rational feelings aside, and I feel in a very uplifting mood, because if we look at this tournament, we have seen that European teams have not done very well. Spain was considered like a big contender before the World Cup. It was a major. The performance was very disappointing. Italy has been very disappointing. I mean, they couldn't beat New Zealand, for example. Paraguay has been a very nice surprise. So I have to say that I think Chile has a decent chance with Spain. Yeah, you are right. I wish I could say that Chile would advance to the second round, but it's not certain yet. On the other hand, let's be realistic. I mean, Chile, in the event that it were to go to the second phase, is going to have to face Portugal or Brazil. And that's a different story there. I mean, it's not a trivial matter.
That's true. If they there's a chance, of course, that Spain would face off against Portugal, but there's a good chance that Portugal could face Chile, and a chance Chile could face Brazil. Either way, not very welcoming in the second round for Chile. Now, let's talk about the soccer in Chilean society over the past century, for instance. The role of soccer in Chile. How huge of a sport has it been, and how significant is it right now in contemporary Chilean society that the team is doing as well as it is and is qualified for the World Cup?
Well, soccer has been a major part of Chilean history. Yeah, people from all social classes, from all political sides, I mean, left-wing, center, right-wing people, upper class, working class, they all really love soccer. Chile, one has to be honest, is not really a powerhouse when it comes to soccer, has never won any big competition except for the South American Cup once. That said, Chileans are fascinated by soccer. So the country today stop around the time of the game, and Chileans vibrate with soccer as many as any, I mean, pretty much like in any other country in Latin America. I mean, yeah. So Chile has been, or it is, a very loving, it's really in love with soccer, has been in love with soccer since the beginning, I mean.
And, of course, in 1962, Chile hosted the World Cup, a World Cup that was won by Brazil. And,
correct. And it was the only time that Chile did reasonably well in a World Cup. They earned the third place.
And I do want to ask a final question, which is obviously Chile and the political history of Chile, the great and tragic episode was the overthrow of Salvador Allende's government in 1973 that led to the Pinochet regime. And the broad, popular, democratic left of Allende's Chile, how significant was soccer in the culture of that left? Was it a standout element of the sort of cohesion and cross-class solidarity that existed in Allende's Chile?
Well, I would say that, I mean, people from the left, and I have quite a few friends from the left, they really love soccer. And as I said before, I have to say also that people from right-wing the side of the political spectrum, they also love soccer. I mean, soccer is a sort of a funny thing here because it seems to agglutinate people from different sides of the political spectrum. Yeah? There are Chilean politicians, for example, who I wouldn't say hate each other, but they yell at each other when they are in Congress, and then you see them on the weekends next to each other cheering for the same soccer team.
Well, let me focus the question just a little bit more, because it's not so much a question of whether right and left, but even within the left, there's a question always of whether sport, is it just bread and circuses, is it an opiate of the masses, or is it something that can play a positive role? So your sense looking back at the Allende era was that the people and the students and the workers who were a part of the movement that propelled Allende into power, they wholeheartedly embraced soccer, though.
I think so, yeah. But the same could have been said about the many other segments of the Chilean society, yeah. But that's true. I think that's correct. Pinochet was never accepted by most Chileans anyway, but I don't think it's whether Pinochet could use soccer to his advantage. I don't think that was the case, yeah.
And so you're upbeat going into the final match against Spain, and I can only imagine that if they were to defeat and eliminate Spain or even just move forward with a draw or even just move forward, the streets of Santiago will be filled again in 4 days' time.
Well, if Chile beats Spain, Chilean GDP will go 1% more than the expected growth rate. Yeah, I think there will be a sort of a self-esteem boost, and Chileans will be probably celebrating forever and ever. I mean, that's the reality, probably, yeah. But I'm holding my breath until Friday. I mean, I don't want to jump to conclusions because we know that soccer is very difficult. You know, it's very difficult to make financial predictions, and to make predictions in soccer is even more difficult.
And I suppose I should ask a social point, closer to the present than the Allende years, which is the terrible earthquake in Chile obviously was a tremendous social trauma for Chile. Is the cohesion that's taking place socially with the Chilean national team winning its first two matches in the World Cup, in a sense, part of the emotional recovery process from that trauma?
I think so. A lot of people were a little bit depressed and not in a somber mood after the quake for obvious reasons. And after Chile won the first game against Honduras, it was the first time in a long time that I went to the street and I saw people who are not particularly, I would say, fond of soccer, like a 70-year-old lady shopping or something like that, and they all look happy. I mean, their faces were cheerful, and they felt pretty positive about that, even though they probably, as I said, I mean, my mother is 91-year-old. She doesn't really care about soccer, but she seemed to be particularly happy that day.
Well, Arturo Cifuentes, I know that there will be joy in the streets of Santiago if Chile advances into the second round. I actually think the team is really solid. I think they play very cohesively. They have a lot of skill in a lot of places, but we'll see when they face top teams. And right off next is Spain. We'll see just how strong this Chilean side really is. And thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you about soccer. Huh?
The Honduran national team qualified for this year's World Cup. I believe it's the second time in the history of the national side that they've qualified for the World Cup. The political history of Honduras, of course, is somewhat famous in global football as Honduras and El Salvador in the late 1960s going into 1970 were involved in what's been known as the football war. But the political resonance of the Honduran national team is much more relevant these days given the political dynamics within Honduras today. As most listeners would know, the elected president of the country, Manuel Zelaya, was overthrown in Honduras last year in what really seemed like a throwback to a decades earlier right-wing coup in Latin America. So how does the success and the great success of the Honduran national team just to qualify for the World Cup finals in South Africa play into the political crisis in Honduras? I'm joined right now by Anselmo Ramos from the Honduran Resistance of Los Angeles. So Anselmo, the team is in South Africa. They have a very strong group of players. And how has this success for the national team impacted the political crisis in Honduras?
Well, thank you for allowing me to participate in your program. Let me clarify something, like going back to the war that took place between Honduras and El Salvador. Both countries, they tried to lie to the people saying that the war was because of soccer, which is not true. That's a complete lie. That's what they told the people. However, the reason why they fought is because the oligarchy from El Salvador with the oligarchs of Honduras, they were fighting over the common market in Central America and because of the internal social problems that they had. So it had nothing to do with soccer. And today's team, again, the group of people or oligarchs, what they're trying to do is they're trying to use the soccer team, those players, which, by the way, they come from humble beginnings, but they are trying to utilize them in for their propaganda. So any success that they have in the World Cup is going to be used using the media that they have in their favor as something that they can show for a success of their system, and which is also not true. In Honduras, they're trying to use that to overshadow the popular movement, which is actually fighting for equality of all Honduran citizens.
And by the way, thank you for clarifying that about the soccer war. In fact, the details that I do know about is, in fact, the attack that did take place, the military attack, was actually months after the conflict between the fans. And the fact that it's known as that, I always thought was Of course it was perverse. But sadly, it's entered sort of global football mythology. So the success of the team, and I understand that there were great public demonstrations that took place in the immediate aftermath of the overthrow of Zelaya. And my understanding was that the success of the team in qualifying for the World Cup finals and their final match and through which they won a big victory and therefore qualified did, in fact, impact negatively the popular movements in terms of people, in a sense, being distracted and, in effect, co-opted by the success of the soccer team.
In fact, that's exactly what they want to do. They don't tell the people that actually that it was because of the support that the people, the humble people of Honduras gave to this team, that that's how the success came. It came because of the people. Not because of the government institutions or the oligarchs that have been involved in actually stealing money from the production that these players actually do. Again, all these players come from humble beginnings. Their success is because of the people, not because of those people that actually take the money away from them or from the production that they do in stadiums and so forth. But it has had a negative impact in the popular movement, and that's exactly what they want. They're trying to show off a team saying that it's coming from a democratic society, which is absolutely a complete lie.
Right, and again, if listeners to The People's Game are not aware, and I imagine you all are, what has happened in Honduras has been wholly outrageous with the overthrow of a elected president who had not really been elected on a highly progressive platform, but once he became president, started to make some moves that were for the benefit of the general population of Honduras. This was not tolerable in the eyes of the country's oligarchs who overthrew him. And then the U.S. played a particularly terrible role in that, while almost all the countries in the regions condemned it, of course, the United States plays a privileged role in whether they're going to accept or condemn such an action. And the United States basically sat on their hands. And then what followed was a sham election in which there was no one to represent anything close to the political positions the President Zelaya had taken, which had been more popular with the general population. And so the sitting government is truly heirs to an illegal and unjust coup.
That is absolutely right. The current government actually is not governing the people of Honduras, because the people of Honduras do not recognize the regime. It was imposed by military force. And so that's why we ask the entire world not to recognize this government, because it represses, in fact, it has assassinated students, workers, teachers, journalists. They are killing individuals that are actually the backbone of the popular movement in order to disarticulate this movement, because the entire population of Honduras does not support this government. It's kept in power by the military force, which is, by the way, sponsored by the United States. But one thing that needs to be clear is when we talk about the United States, we're not talking about the people of the United Right. States. We always talk about the government and the right-wing elite of the United States that supports this type of governments and dictatorships throughout Latin America.
Right, and people, again, should be aware of the time frame, because this did not take place under George W. Bush's watch. I know many people out there are listening would expect wholly the Bush administration, the Bush-Cheney administration, and every Bush administration of all 12 years of them throughout the Bush family to have supported such a coup. But this happened while President Obama was in office. And again, the response of the United States has been as disgraceful as would have been expected under Bush-Cheney.
That is correct. And a lot of people have been misguided by saying that President Manuel Zelaya committed corruption and so forth. What we said was the following. Well, if he did, then there were proper channels to bring him to justice. But that didn't happen. And so what they did was they kidnapped the president, they broke into his home, and they expelled the president out of the country. That is illegal. That is a crime. And it doesn't matter what they say or how they want to cover that up, it's not going to happen. And so we expect the entire world, all the citizens of this planet that love democracy, not to ever recognize or support this government.
So again, back to the interface then of soccer and politics in Honduras. Has the resistance had any contact with the team or the players, any show of solidarity whatsoever from any of the players on the team?
Officially not. Like the people of Honduras do feel that they, I guess most Hondurans, they love soccer. And that's why we call it the people's game. I love soccer. I grew up playing soccer. But this team, this particular team, it played a role that was negative for the people of Honduras. They actually went to the presidential palace to sit there with the dictator that was in charge of the government at that moment, which was Roberto Micheletti, which, by the way, we call him a terrorist because he assassinated Honduran citizens. They actually went there to sit with him. And that's something that the people of Honduras, besides the fact that they love soccer, they will not forgive, nor they will forget. And it has nothing to do with us not supporting a soccer team that represents our country. It has to do with the actions that they took, that they go against the national interest.
Sadly, however, the power of soccer, and again, so often sadly, I mean, the most famous instance, of course, is 1978 in Argentina, where Argentina won the World Cup, which was really disgracefully held in Argentina, the fact that FIFA, the governing body of soccer, would allow a fascist dictatorship to host the World Cup. And then Argentina went on to win, and, you know, this played a, you know, very dismaying role in boosting the dictatorship in Argentina. However, is this unfortunately transpiring in Honduras, and that people's love of soccer is creating a sort of propaganda coup for the government?
In fact, we believe that possibly the best thing for FIFA to have done was maybe to prohibit Honduras to participate like the rest of the Central American countries did. They forbid Honduras to participate in any sporting events in the region because of what they did to the people of Honduras. And so that's what we expected from FIFA. However, that did not happen.
And in Honduras, though, people are following the team closely?
But they do. They actually are following the team, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily supporting what they do or the philosophy that they run on.
Yeah, it is a shame. I know these players well, some of them. They play for, have played, or they play for a club side that I root for in England. And I like them a lot, and I felt highly ambiguous about them ever since this happened because I didn't know what their response had been. And I really wish, and for what it's worth, if this recording gets anywhere near Wilson Palacios or Maynard Figueroa and the other stars from the Honduran team, I would really just bequeath them to support the Honduran people.
And one of the issues that we have is it's at times they have become arrogant, even with the people that actually supported them in their beginnings in the stadiums of Honduras. And there has been times that there was even a player, that there was a humble lady in a shopping center that went to ask for an autograph to him. He just ignored her. He just walked by and not even pay attention. Those are the things that we condemn. This is arrogance, that they believe that they are above the rest of the population. Well, bad news, they are not.
Anselmo Ramos, your words to the ears of the Honduran national team, what would you like to see them do if they could do anything right now to support the Honduran people?
What they could do right now, or the best thing that they could do, since they are on an international, or they're in the eyes of the world at this moment, they could actually condemn what happened in Honduras and say that they support the people of our country and say, we condemn the repression. We do not recognize the regime that was imposed by military force in Honduras, and we are here for the people of our country, not for those that right now are holding power in Honduras through weaponry and assassinations.
Anselmo Ramos from the Honduran Resistance of Los Angeles, thank you very much for joining us on The People's Game.
Thank you.